Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. We need your help. Become a member of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast, and you will keep this show on the air. You'll keep us on terrestrial radio, and you'll keep us producing a podcast every single week. You constitute, or I should say our members, constitute 100% of our revenue. So become a member today. You get the show commercial free. You'll have access to our archives that stretches over 10 years ago now. Gosh, maybe closer to 15 years worth of an archive. Check it out, folks. ROFpodcast.com. It's your support that keeps us on the air. Thanks so much for listening. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Stephanie Mensimer from Mother Jones will explain how right-wing groups are training the next generation to own the libs on social media. Alex Hertel Fernandez will join us to discuss his new book, State Capture, How Conservative Activists, Big Business, and Wealthy Donors Reshaped the American States and the Nation. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will join me to discuss the biggest news stories of the week. And Paul Waldman from the American Prospect joins us to explain why Joe Biden is a link to the past, and not in a good way. If you're new to the show, you can find the free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. And if you like the show, you can support Ring of Fire Radio by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show commercial-free. You can go to ROFpodcast.com to sign up. Here to run down the biggest stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her, Digby. So, Heather, we are now the week two in the sort of waiting now for the Mueller report to be given to Congress. This week, the Democrats in Congress voted to subpoena the report. It is unclear. It seems to me that it's unclear, you know, what's going on with the report. On one hand, we hear that there's a process in which redactions must go through, and we don't know exactly the size of the report. We've heard all sorts of different reporting as to the size of the report, they must go to get a order from a judge to share parts of the grand jury testimony and information, if they're going to share it with Congress. But that, to me, seems like it couldn't take that long. The Democrats certainly felt like there was a need to subpoena it. I think regardless of what's in the report, it should be made at least available, at least it seems to me, as a baseline available to members of Congress. I mean, I don't even see how it couldn't be at this point, right? I mean, presumably, there's also reports that at least the Intel Committee would have seen in terms of the intelligence investigation into this stuff, right?
Absolutely. I mean, look, this is probably the most momentous presidential scandal in our history because of the foreign activity around it. I mean, it goes beyond Richard Nixon in terms of the sort of scope of it and the implications of it for, you know, American national security. There has been, you know, people have been seeing, you know, story after story after story for the last 2 years that lent all kinds of suspicions to what was going on. There is absolutely no way that the Congress shouldn't see it and that the Congress shouldn't be in a position to release virtually all of it to the public. I mean, this is just, there's never been, other than maybe the 9/11 report I can think of, that has the kind of you know, importance to the public to sort of get the full story in order to understand what happened there. And the idea that they're going to try and suppress us. And look, I think Jerry Nadler, who's the one who, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, who has, you know, gone very aggressively saying we're going to vote to subpoena subpoena the report. And he also, by the way, said that we're going to vote to subpoena certain people about their grand jury, testimony. And there's a good reason for that. You know, if they decide to go and you know, fight this in the courts, which they probably will, despite all of the, you know, Republicans in the House voting to release the report, and despite the president saying we can release the report, you know they're going to fight it, because they know that no matter whether or not there's any criminal charges stemming from this investigation, there's plenty to implicate the president in really disgusting wrongdoing. So they don't want that to come out. But nonetheless, this is going to be a fight. And what Nadler has done is he's put down a marker, and he's saying, look, we're not just going to roll over here. We are going to pursue this. This is on the table. And you can see the Republicans fighting back. Their strategy is to say, oh, look, they're obsessed. It's a witch hunt. It's time to move on. We need to, you know, start. We need to, you know, run the country. The president's been saying that. And by the way, they're working the media on that, because the media is starting to say, is this Democratic overreach? They won't be able to get these documents. And gosh, that, you know, are they making it easy for Trump to call it a witch hunt, et cetera, et cetera. So you can see the sort of political strategy around it. It doesn't matter. And I think Nadler gets that, and I think Schiff does too on the intelligence side. You know, they're saying, look, this is our, there's been zero oversight for 2 years, and all this stuff has been going on, and we are going to look at it one way or the other. And by subpoenaing these people, which are like Don McGahn and Rens Priebus and some of the other people who were involved in potentially the obstruction side of it, what they're going to do is ask them to agree to release their grand jury testimony. And, you know, whether or not they do that, I don't know. But that's another direction you can go to. You know, a person who testifies before the grand jury can say whatever they want about their testimony. There's no law against it. It's that the government can't release that information.
Right.
So they're hoping to put pressure on from that direction as well. These people all have reputations. They have, you know, their place in history. I mean, it's unknown yet how far all of them will go to protect Donald Trump. So I think that the Democrats are being very aggressive about that, and rightfully so. And they're going to have to learn to take some heat from the media, because I'm already seeing Chuck Todd and, you know, people, you know, villagers coming around going, oh, well, this is really tough, and the Democrats are putting themselves in a bad position, and, you know, they need to think about whether or not they can go into the election, you know, pursuing Donald Trump. And I think that these people are, you know, I think Nadler and Schiff and Pelosi, too, presumably, are saying, you know, yeah, whatever, talk to the hand, you know.
Well, I mean, look, the bottom line is, regardless of what your disposition is on the report, it seems to me to be almost unconscionable that whether you think that Donald Trump was a complete witch hunt, or whether you think there was enough evidence that just couldn't be, that just didn't reach the threshold of something that that Mueller thought was worthy of an indictment, or that the laws are narrowly tailored enough that, like, you could still have, you know, some measure of quid pro quo, or the president could be operating because, you know, he thought that he was going to get business in Russia and didn't think he'd ever have to make good on anything that was implied that he would do for the Russians, or for anybody else for that matter, the Saudis, the whoever. You'd want the report out there so that the American public would have some awareness of either the abuses that have gone on in the context of this investigation, or in the findings. I mean, I just don't know how that is in any way defensible. At the very least, you'd want the representatives of the lawmakers to see it. I mean, otherwise, it seems to do a disservice to regardless of what your perspective on this. I mean, if this was, as some, I think, who are certainly some Republicans are claiming, some type of witch hunt and, you know, assault on the presidency, well, then by all means, release the report. And, you know, let's hold people to account for that, if that's what it was. So I think it seems sort of shocking. And all right, well, let's take a break. And when we come back, I guess we'll talk a little more about this. I'm curious if you think that it's possible for Democrats to run and or walk and chew gum at the same time. And I also want to talk about some of the demobilization that we may be seeing in terms of the results of some elections this week. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, in the last segment, we talked about the attempts by the Democrats to get the to at the very least, I don't know if the to make the Mueller report public, but at the very least, to have members of the Judiciary Committee be able to review the report. It is. I don't know how big of a document it is, but it sounds like it's pretty big. And the assessment of the attorney general as to, you know, what the report says, I don't think is sufficient when we have something of this seriousness. And it's either, you know, like I said in the last segment, it's either a been a witch hunt that has targeted Donald Trump unfairly, in which case the report should be seen by all members of Congress so that we can as a nation deal with this and talk about the attempted coup that this might signify. Or we should also be aware of, you know, to what thresholds were crossed in terms of the evidence that Mueller found. We know that the report, or at least the investigation itself, has according to the Barr memo, and you know, maybe we should believe it, maybe we shouldn't, but it's all the more reason to see the report, that a foreign government, a foreign entity, attempted to influence the election. Maybe they did have some influence, maybe they didn't. I don't know how we would measure that necessarily, but all of this stuff needs to be released. And I'm curious, do you think that this report there's a danger that Democrats will rely on this report as opposed to anything else from a political standpoint? Because I don't necessarily get the sense that that's, I mean, the 2018 election, it seems to me, was very much about healthcare. And it seems to me that the Democrats are gearing up to make it about 2020 about healthcare again, too.
Well, I think they are. Yeah. I mean, they can, and especially since Donald Trump walked into this ridiculous maelstrom over healthcare by saying that he was going, you know, by joining that lawsuit and then, you know, insisting against the advice of his attorney general and others in his administration to join that lawsuit to overturn Obamacare and then say, oh, well, you know, we're going to replace it with something really great. I mean, this was a big political mistake. I mean, even Mitch McConnell isn't nihilistic enough to say that, you know, it's a great plan to overturn Obamacare with nothing to replace it and then, you know, try and squeeze the Democrats to pass some horrible Republican plan just to save some of the lives that are going to be lost from that. So even he didn't go along with that idea, so, which was Trump's plan. I mean, that was his strategy, right? I mean, he wanted it overturned, and then that we'd be looking at this horror of people suddenly overnight becoming uncovered and that was the method by which he'd strong-arm the Democrats into doing it his way. That was what they were going to do. And you know, McConnell's going, no, that's not going to work for us. And they backed off and said, well, we're going to do it at, you know, after the election. So Democrats understand that that is what they're going to run on. And if you look at the candidates out there, they're not running explicitly on Trump. I mean, of course he comes up, and of course they talk about, you know, what a devastating presidency it is. But that's not their top line. They're talking about all the issues that stem from this presidency and from the Republican agenda, health care. And they're talking about income inequality. They're talking about college loans. They're talking about, you know, a lot of bread and butter issues, you know, and not so bread and butter, even things like immigration. I mean, that's a big part of both Julian Castro and Beto O'Rourke's pitch. I mean, there are a lot of things, you know, there's prison reform. There's a long list of agenda that the Democrats are going to run on. But Trump, of course, is part of it. And I don't see any reason why that precludes them doing their job in the Congress. And in fact, that is one of the reasons why they won in 2018, was that people expected them to come in and do that oversight. I mean, people understand that Democrats are not going to pass any laws in the next 2 years. That's not happening. You know, the best they can do is kind of, you know, pass some bills in the House that lay out what their agenda is and what their wish list is, and they're doing that. They passed a gun control bill. They passed H.R. 1, the government reform and election reform bill. I mean, they've passed bills, and they have those to run on, and they'll continue to do that. But this oversight, I mean, that's something that you know, they have to do. It's their duty to do it, and it's also, I think, what Democratic voters expected them to do. So, I don't think this idea that they can't walk and chew gum at the same time, I don't see that happening, you know. I mean, whether or not, you know, you mentioned the potential demobilization of the Democratic, you know, grassroots that went into 2018 and made such a big splash, and I think there is some danger of there.
Right.
But I'm kind of thinking maybe people are taking a little break. You know, Trump is still in the White House, and I think we're coming into 2020. I think that mobilization will return. This is exhausting stuff, and most of these people who work in grassroots politics are, you know, they have other lives too. They've got jobs, they've got families, and I think maybe, you know, I sort of suspect, I don't know that for sure, but that, I just can't believe that everybody's going, okay, well, we're done now. I mean, look, he's still there, and
right,
all this awful stuff is still happening, so anyway.
You know, and there's an interesting way to maybe perhaps test this thesis, and that was there were some elections this week. There was one state Senate seat in Pennsylvania. There was a very, very important election in Wisconsin for the state Supreme Court. And there was some, local elections in Chicago, not such a small town. The results of all those elections are fascinating, both when you look at them individually, but also, you know, you can compare them because they all happen on the same day. So we have this sort of like temporal control. We got to take a break. When we come back in the next hour, I want to talk about those elections. I want to talk about what's come out this week in terms of the 2020 primary. We are only now about 2 months away from the first debates. And as terrifying as that sounds, we heard about, we're going to talk about candidates, what's come out about Joe Biden, and what's come out about fundraising, all that and more in the next hour, if you'll join me, Digby. In the meantime, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Ring of Fire Radio. Coming up, we'll take a look into a possible Joe Biden presidential run with Paul Waldman from the American Prospect. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
Conduct. conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Don't forget ROFpodcast.com to become a member of this show. You know, Joe Biden's name has resonated well in some early polling, focusing on Democratic candidates looking to run against Donald Trump in the 2020 election. Here to discuss why the former vice president's policies are at odds with a more progressive Democratic Party, Paul Waldman from the American Prospect. So, Paul, Joe Biden, perhaps the most well-known of, I guess we would call him a potential candidate at this point, could announce that he's coming in any moment. Let's just start with, you know, what your sense is of how he is seen by the a large portion of the Democratic Party today, because it has been almost 12 years in some ways since he's had his own identity that wasn't so tied into the Obama presidency. But give me your sense of just like, you know, what the thumbnail of Joe Biden is today.
I think we're going to see, and maybe we're already seeing, a big generational divide in how Democrats view him, because he is in many ways such a kind of old school politician in both style and substance. And you're right, you know, he was a guy who had been in the Senate for over 30 years, ran for president unsuccessfully a couple times. And then when Obama plucked him to be his vice president, you know, that kind of gave him a new political life. And by all accounts, he was a very successful vice president, especially when it came to getting the stimulus implemented. That was something that people who reported on that, which are not very many reporters since that kind of stuff doesn't get a lot of attention, they say he really did a terrific job on that. But now he is, as you say, coming out and kind of presenting himself as his own man anew. And we're seeing all the things about his prior record get reexamined in the light of how people look at politics and things like gender relations in 2019. And so he's got a lot of his record that he can point to that's very positive, but also things like what his management of the Clarence Thomas confirmation hearings are getting reevaluated. His work on the 1994 crime bill, which was extremely harsh. You know, his things like that are getting viewed again, and you get the sense that he's not necessarily so prepared for this.
Yes.
You know, and right now he doesn't have a campaign, which I think may make it a little worse as this new controversy over his handsiness has come up. You know, he doesn't have an apparatus. He's not out there every day talking to reporters and to voters. He's just got a couple of sort of spokespeople around him who are trying to handle it. But I think this is an interesting sort of symbolic moment, even beyond the substance of how he deals with people and what that says about him. You're seeing this politician who's in his mid-70s suddenly have to account for behaviors that he's been doing forever,
right?
But suddenly are being judged by a different set of standards.
Right. I mean, that is an apt metaphor in many respects, because the ground has shifted, it seems to me, so dramatically over the past 5 to 10 years, maybe even more narrow, but certainly in the wake of the financial crisis, I think, which is what brought a lot of this stuff to head. And of course, other cultural, socio-cultural dynamics. But let me ask you this. Let's just start with this, because, you know, you mentioned that Joe Biden has run for president at least two other times, I think it was. And he wasn't close. Right. Like, he wasn't one of those people who came in like third. He was one of those people who was out really early in both instances. Of course, back, I think it was in 88, he was out because of a plagiarism scandal. And we can talk about that. But let me ask you this. Why do you think he's waited so long to get in. I mean, that's, you know, and I bring this up because I want to first deal with his skill set as a politician and then go back on his record, which I think, you know, oddly enough, there's a generational divide in terms of Joe Biden. But the generation that's not aware of some of his politics, I think, from back in the day, tend to be the most skeptical of him. Which is an interesting dynamic, but just in terms of his skill as a politician, like what's the theory with him waiting this long? Do you think if he ultimately decides to run, or maybe he hasn't decided to run?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about him is that unlike many politicians, he's never been coy about his desire to be president. But you know, things always seem to conspire against him. As you said, the first time he ran, he had that plagiarism scandal and pulled out before there were any votes. The second time he ran in 2008, he did really poorly in the Iowa caucus and then pulled out right after Iowa. And so that was it for him. Then, you know, he signed on as Obama's vice president. And in 2016, he surely wanted to run again, but was basically looked at the situation and was made to understand that, you know, this was Hillary Clinton's turn and the whole party was lining up behind her and he was going to have a very tough time. But he never let go of his desire to be president. And so this time around, you know, I think that he really has seemed like he can't decide if he can really do it or not. You know, right. Is he too old? Are there too many other new and interesting candidates? Is it going to be too difficult? So I think that's been the delay. But I think he also has felt probably with some justification. If he looks at the polls, he can say, well, you know, I'm still the most known. I'm at the top of the polls. You know, I'm pulling 25-30% more than anybody else. You know, Bernie Sanders may be close behind. But he probably thinks, you know, I don't need to, you know, beat Beto O'Rourke to the next event because I can get in a little later. So I think that's probably what he's thinking, but he's never made any bones about the fact that he would like to be president, and he thinks he should be.
Do you think that he's been, you know, in terms of this period where, you know, the run up to him running, I can think of two occasions where he, and he's probably done more, but I haven't been watching him closely, where he has done this thing where he crosses himself as a good Catholic and says something to the effect of forgive me, Father, for I have sinned, in the context of a couple of different things. I think one of them was, having friends with Republicans, and saying some other stuff that was there's a defensiveness there that makes me feel like maybe he is aware that he's a little bit out of step and isn't quite sure what is going on. Like, let's talk about the Stacey Abrams thing. His camp denies that they floated the idea of Stacey Abrams being his vice president. And it was quite clear within a couple of days, based upon her response, that this is nothing that was run by her at all. Something like this also happened with Elizabeth Warren back in 2016 when he was contemplating running. It seems to me that that's also a metaphor of some of his problems. The idea that, you know, maybe back in the day you felt like as a politician like this, that whatever my status is, this other person should be, grateful or can't do anything about me sort of leveraging them. And, you know, it's quite clear what the idea is. I want to project to people that I would pick someone like Stacey Abrams or Stacey Abrams herself, because that means that I'm amenable in certain areas that maybe people perceive as being a deficit. Right. Questions of race, questions of gender. But what does that tell us about what do you think about the fact that Stacey Abrams, when she was asked this on The View. Right. And she could have said, I'm really flattered. The idea of being Joe Biden's VP is, you know, would be quite an honor. But I'm not interested in that. She didn't say that. She just said, I'm not running for, you know, second place. Nobody would want to do that. What do you make of that? Like, what do you think he picked up any type of signal from that? Because he got away with it with Elizabeth Warren back in 2016. But what's your sense of that?
Yeah, I think the Stacey Abrams thing is fascinating. It's unclear whether it was just something that his staff might have floated and maybe to get him to convince him that it was a good idea. But, you know, as you say, wherever it came from, it died pretty quick. But what's interesting is that they represent two things that are so different, not just because she's young and he's old and she's a black woman and he's a white man, but they have fundamentally different ideas about what the Democratic Party needs to do to win. Stacey Abrams, her political philosophy is that Democrats need to find the voters who are not voting. She has started two different organizations devoted to registering people and securing voting rights. And she, as a politician in Georgia, spent lots of time going out and meeting all the voters she could from every area and people of all races. However, she was quite clear that the way for Democrats to win was not to go to the center and not to like chase after that elusive white male, but to get all of those disengaged voters who are sort of Democrats in waiting, get them registered and get them to the polls. And she did it and almost won. And some people, including herself, I think would think that she actually won. What was it not for for the vote suppression of her opponent? That's the philosophy that she represents, and Joe Biden is exactly the opposite. The whole the basis of his political persona and the reason why he's supposed to be electable is not because he's going to mobilize Democrats, but because he's the guy who can speak to those people in the diners in the Midwest, the white men who feel like they're being left behind. Joe Biden is supposed to be the guy who could reach out to them.
Right,
and so they're two so different political personas and philosophies about how Democrats can win.
Paul, we got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more in just a moment. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now, I'm talking with Paul Waldman from the American Prospect about his article, Joe Biden is a Link to the Past, and not in a good way. So, Paul, the last thing we were talking about before the break was the Joe Biden, you know, maybe we don't know, but his camp may be floating the idea of running with Stacey Abrams. And you made the point that they really represent two very different sets of perspective on how to win with the Democrat, you know, in a general election. Stacey Abrams, activate, mobilize voters who would vote Democratic but don't necessarily vote that often. Joe Biden, supposedly the persuader who's going to convince maybe those Reagan Democrats, to the extent that any of them are still alive, that they should come vote for him. All right, well, let's go back and get to the nub of this, and that is that Joe Biden, his politics in the past, pre-Obama, were not very good by today's standards of what is sort of a typical Democratic position. I mean, maybe even then, frankly, too. I'm old enough to remember people referred to Joe Biden as the senator from MBNA. But what stands out for you in terms of Joe Biden's past that would be a real liability for him running in this Democratic primary?
Well, I think he's going to get a lot more questions about the Anita Hill hearings. He was the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee at the time. You know, as people will remember, Anita Hill, who subsequent reporting validated that she was absolutely telling the truth in all of the accusations she made against Clarence Thomas. And Biden essentially allowed her to be terribly abused by that committee and, you know, by Republicans in general. And he still can't figure out how to talk about that. Right. You know, he said recently, "I wish there was something I could have done." And then, you know, one of the things he could have done, for instance, is allowed the three other women who had told the committee that they were ready to testify and corroborate Anita Hill's testimony. He could have let them testify, but he didn't. And I think that's something that is going to be going come up again and again and again. And, you know, I think one thing I would refer people to, Rebecca Traister wrote a terrific piece in New York Magazine that's on their website now, looking back at his history. And, you know, one of the points that she makes is that he has always been the kind of the guy who whose job it was or who saw himself as being able to sell the Democratic Party to people who might otherwise be voting Republican, especially, you know, those white guys. And but the problem is that in the process, he often sort of validated their own complaints about societal progress, about what the Democratic Party was becoming, whether that was their racial complaints, and, you know, Biden became an opponent of busing, whether that was their complaints about feminism, about immigration. Biden was always there to sort of validate them and say, but yeah, you know, you can still find a home in the Democratic Party. And whatever you might think about the need for somebody like that to be speaking to those voters, in 2020, the Democratic Party is very different than it used to be. And I think that even though there are many people in the Democratic Party who still think that it's vital for Democrats to, you know, to quote unquote reach out to people who might otherwise be voting Republican, it is a very different coalition now than it was when Biden first came on into public office in the 1970s or even in the 80s or 90s or even 10 years ago. It's a much more diverse party. It's a party that relies very much, as it always has, on African Americans, but also on Latinos and also on Asian Americans and on young people. And the idea that it would be led by somebody who sees his job as kind of translating, Democratic policies for those people who are unnerved and hostile to the progress in society, the changes in society that the Democratic Party wants to take advantage of and sees itself supporting, that's going to be a very, very tricky kind of line for him to walk. And it'll be interesting to see how he presents that case.
Yeah, I think she said, and I hope I'm not misattributing this, but, you know, the idea of defeating Trump with a brand of Trumpism, you're not defeating Trumpism, right? If he is basically saying, like, we're not so offensive to that Trumpistic, if you will, sensibility. But the other thing that occurs to me as you're saying this is that, and we just have about 2 minutes left here, is that he's also got a problem on the finance side, right? Which you don't necessarily associate with the white working class, but this is a guy who, when push came to shove, maybe it's because of the state he came from, but he sided with finance over those people who were in debt and trying to discharge in like Chapter 11 and bankruptcy, big loans. And that sort of is inconsistent with that other part of him, isn't it?
Yes, and I think, you know, if you're going to see that argument for somebody, for instance, from somebody like Elizabeth Warren, who has clashed with him in the past over this. It's not like he's Mitt Romney, you know, a rich guy who is trying to advance the interests of his class. But he has, and maybe in large part because he comes from Delaware, he has often advanced the interests of the banking industry and the credit card industry. And those are things that are no longer tolerable in the Democratic Party, frankly. They used to be. You know, there was a whole period, especially through the 1990s, where, you know, there was a kind of a feeling in the Democratic Party like, okay, you know, we got to raise money. We have to, kind of make peace with the finance industry, and that will be our path to success. And you could argue maybe that it was, but right now there's much more energy in the Democratic Party from people who feel like we have to change this system. And there's a lot of fodder in Biden's record for people criticizing him for standing up for the credit card industry or the banking industry when they wanted to do things that were not in the interest of ordinary people.
Well, it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out. And I imagine Joe Biden is aware of, there hasn't been, I got to say, a lot of pieces that I've seen out there saying Joe Biden is the perfect recipe for the Democratic Party to win in 2020. But we shall see. Paul Waldman, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Sam. Thank you.
Paul Waldman is a weekly columnist and senior writer for the American Prospect. He also writes for the Plumline blog at Washington Post and The Week. He's the author of Being Right Is Not Enough: What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You are listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show.